Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
Thank you for joining us and welcome to Mind Food Radio with Ben Starr and Michael McHugh today. Coming up on today's program, Lyndall Miller's going to join us very shortly talking about, well, sugar. We've got Jacqueline Hellier coming up first today in the sex room. She'll be giving us some sex advice. We're going to talk Italian gardens with Angus Stewart, of course, and a very interesting interview coming up today on mindfulness. Also on the program, understanding Alzheimer's. It's on the growth and it's something that we all need to be aware of, nutrition and exercise. And then a little later on, we're going to get into the creative area with Dr. Lee Hodder and talk about creativity. All that and more coming up on today's episode of Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking, the perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Michael, lots of conversation at your work this week.
Well, you know what? The whole thing is, I've got staff members reading the book 50 Shades of Grey. It's by E.L. James.
Yeah.
It's a trilogy. And, you know, we then, of course, got talking about erotic fiction and how it's almost become the norm. And one of them saw a woman reading the book, you know, in the middle of the mall. And it's extraordinary because then we went on and said, you know, in our day, you know, in our Mother's Day, they were having Tupperware parties.
Yes.
One of the staff are off to a sex toy party on Saturday night. And I've got to tell you, the least expected staff member,
always that, isn't it?
I know. And team, I'm not mentioning names.
No, no,
but
don't
you know who
that.
You are. But even Mills and Boons, there's been an increase in sales, you know, with e-readers in and around this. So I want to welcome to the show Jacqueline Hellier. Hello.
Oh, she knows her stuff.
Exactly.
How are you, Jacqueline?
In terms of erotic fiction, what do you think? How important is it in terms of keeping relationships alive?
Oh, look, I think it's wonderful. As a sex therapist, I'm often encouraging couples to get some good quality erotica and read it.
What is good quality, though? Because there's a lot of bad quality out
Ben's
there.
Ben's desperate.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like the difference between smut and erotica,
right?
Yeah. Like, smut is sort of something that makes you feel a bit dirty and sordid and, you know, it's not really life-enhancing, whereas good quality erotica will move you, yeah? It'll move you from within and it makes you feel, opens you up to desire and wanting to make beautiful love and so forth.
Okay.
So, I'm an erotic writer myself, so I'm probably a little bit biased here, although I write therapeutic erotica.
And so I'm what do you write? Tell us what you write, Jacqueline.
How do you get through a paragraph?
Oh, well, I don't know. I guess if you have a gift for writing and for sex scenes. So that's, in fact, when I was looking to become a sex therapist, I was actually in the middle of an erotic novel and I had to decide whether I wanted to keep becoming an erotic writer or become a professional sex therapist. And the academic in me won out, so I went off and did my master's. But but actually what I'm doing at the moment, and I am looking for a publisher, if anyone's listening, hope you don't mind, is that I'm actually, because this is my third book, right, and in this book I'm writing what I call therapeutic erotica. So it's erotica that's written to inform and instruct and inspire people, like, as opposed to just something that's a good read and turns you on. So
are people becoming more conservative, like the teenagers of today, or is it now the oldies are getting a little bit saucy for this type of book, I suppose?
Yeah, well, I think my sense is, right, and I deal with sex all the time, my sense is that there is actually a shift in society at the moment where people are starting to go, hang on, there's got to be more to sex than this, right? It can't just be, you know, this prudish, oh, you know, sex is bad or this completely out there, you know, really sleazy porn type thing where, oh, yeah, you know, gagging for it, hubba hubba. And, you know, people are going, hang on, like this is a really innate drive in us and when it's good, it's absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people are kind of going, well, hang on, how can we learn more about sex and sexuality and the positive impact it can have on our lives? And, like, I think that's where this is coming from, because a lot of the erotica that's being written these days, and I do read quite a lot, is really good. Like, it's really good quality.
So where do you find this? I mean, is it on the book stand at a bookstore?
Although, I've got to tap in here. One of my staff went to 5 bookstores for, you know, the 50 Shades of Grey. It's all sold out.
It's sold out.
She sold something like 10 million...
12.
Is it 12 million copies worldwide?
12. Wow.
It's absolutely crazy.
Yeah, well, I mean, these days, and for a long time, good quality erotica has been in all the good bookstores. Most large bookstores will have erotic sections.
Okay.
And, you know, it's published by Penguin and, you know, HarperCollins and, you know, like really good quality publishers. Now that sex is starting to become more acceptable, we're getting better quality people doing it, whether it's therapy or whether it's writing erotica.
Yeah.
Yeah? And so the better quality it becomes, then the more people will engage. Yeah?
Yep.
And the more they'll get out of it, and so, you know, the more people we'll get into it kind of thing. Yeah. You know?
Hey, Jacqueline, thanks for being on our saucy segment of the program today.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And, of course, today all about erotic fiction. Who knew we were going there?
Okay, thanks very much. Bye-bye.
And for more details, jump onto mindfood.com.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Have you started your circuits in the house because of this wet weather?
Yeah. Well, I do try and walk. I walk at least 20 minutes a day.
Around the house?
No. Around the block with the dog.
Yeah, but with the rain.
Oh, well, in my house. Yeah, I walk. Look, I walk a lot at work. So where I work in you know, education, I have to walk a lot between different rooms and stuff. So I do a lot of walking, but... Yeah, I could do more.
Yeah. Stairs have become a new friend.
Do you have stairs in your place?
Yes.
Oh, at the office, that's right, yeah.
Well, look, today I'd like to welcome to the show again our personal trainer, David Welsh. Hi, David.
G'day.
Now, we often hear from nutritionists and doctors and even psychologists with regards to this, but we've never had a conversation from a personal trainer with regards to this.
I think one of the key things that people need to understand when it comes to maintaining a particular body shape that they want to have is that nutrition is arguably 85% of the trick. The exercise is what you would call the icing on the cake. But the exercise is generally, for most people, is the fun part. The discipline in eating and being strict with your eating is always the most challenging part. Some helpful tips I love to give my clients is portion sizes. That's one of the key things that we need to look at. So many people throughout winter will go to a particular restaurant and order a large spaghetti bolognese, for example, and instead of getting the large, get the children's size or get the entree size.
Yeah.
That's generally one of the key tips I would love to give to my clients, because you are tempted to want to eat heavier foods because it is cold.
Yeah.
But if you can look at those portion sizes and have an idea of what you want to have before you go out, for example, to a restaurant, or if you're sitting at home and you're about to cook a meal with the wife or with the family or whoever it may be, it's all, one of the key things to always look at is, okay, I'm not going to eat till I'm full. I just want to eat till I'm content.
But it does take 20 minutes from your stomach to your brain, doesn't it, to tell your brain that you're full or here comes food.
That's correct.
And so within 20 minutes, you can sort of, eat a whole lot of food.
You can definitely. So that's where you need to look at things from a visual point of view and say, okay, that's generally what I would eat. And, okay, listen, I'm going to eat a little bit less.
Portion control.
Portion control is one thing. The other thing as well is that often so many people make mistakes with is carbohydrates is not our enemy. Again, when it comes to, because carbohydrates is a source of energy. If our body was a carb, then carbohydrates is our fuel.
So it's interesting. The other thing that I was talking to somebody about recently, bread. My doctor said, well, why would you eat bread? It's just glue. Once it gets into your body, flour and water equals glue. And I thought, well, that's a good point.
It is. But there are certain people that don't necessarily need to eat bread. But bread is one of many sources of carbohydrates. Sweet potato, brown rice, even vegetables are carbohydrates. But then they talk about those starchy carbohydrates like your pastas, your bread, and your rices. Again, they're not bad to eat. It's just you have to learn how to control your portion sizes. Dietitians will generally recommend, particularly at night time, if you are somebody that trains 2 to 3 times a week, there's nothing wrong with eating a third of a cup of cooked rice with your meals. Again, it comes down just to portion sizes.
I mean, you look at people who come to you who might be thin. What do you tell them about fitness? I mean, because we all have this preconception that everybody's overweight that goes to go to the gym. That's not right.
No, it's not. I had a great example of that today of a new lady that wanted to come on board with me. When I literally looked at her, I said, I hope you're not coming to me to lose weight. And she goes, no, not at all. And I said, that's great. So in that case there, she told me her diet consists mainly of chocolate, and chocolate. So it was about educating her to try and break her natural habits that she's used to eating with chocolate, and to try to educate her. And I said to her, it's not going to be an easy process because we're used to doing something for so long.
Well, David, really interesting points. Thank you for joining us on today's program.
Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
Time for gardening. Our veggie garden's going well, Michael.
It is. This rain is giving it
pumping it along.
Yeah, well, probably pumping a little bit too much.
Angus would be very impressed. We'll have to send him a photo.
Well, the great thing about Angus is he's finally returned from his overseas trip, and he went to extraordinary gardens in Italy. Welcome to the show, Angus.
Thank you very much.
Now, you went to one of my favourite spots in Italy, Como. What were the gardens like there?
Oh, absolutely fabulous. On the lakes up in the north of Italy. It's a remarkable place because even though it's quite close to Switzerland, you'd think it would be too cold to grow a lot of plants from more temperate regions. But out on the lakes, the islands out there grow a remarkable diversity of species and just a place of great opulence.
But a lot of the homes and gardens around the lake, they are very terraced, aren't they? And they have quite traditional-looking gardens.
Indeed, and that, I think, is the interesting thing about Italian gardens. It's often more about form rather than flowers. So the terracing and of course, the olive trees and all the vegetables that go in around the ornamental plants.
And tell us, what were the gardens like in Florence? Because Florence is sort of different again geographically.
Well, again, it's often about terracing because it's a pretty mountainous country, Italy, and so they learn to make use of as much space as possible. And often around Florence, it's all about the hills overlooking the valleys, and so the gardens are framed around the beautiful views back down to Florence. So you can imagine the early cardinals and people like that lounging about in the gardens, drinking wine and eating olives and overlooking Florence.
Well, while you were there, I was in Bologna in earth-torn, war-torn, earthquake territory, clinging onto a cherry tree, and one of my guests took me around her cherry tree orchard. What I found amazing when you get out into the countryside there, how beautiful it is, but not only that, how stuff just grows. It looks so different.
Well, indeed, and I think the point there, as well as being mountainous, there are a lot of volcanic eruptions and so on that have occurred over the last few thousand years, and the lava and so on creates an amazing sort of fertile soil when it breaks down. So that really is why Italy is a bit of a food bowl as well as a place of magnificent gardens.
A question I wanted to ask you, and I don't know whether you got any of this, but when I went into Rome recently, that city is a beautiful city, but pollution and all the stuff that goes with it, how important is it that we have trees around us to maintain pollution and things like that?
Look, yes, it has a quite an astonishing effect on mitigating air pollution and producing more oxygen and mitigating temperature as well. The urban forest is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, well, there's not much of it in Rome. You walk around the streets and you sort of think, God, I'd love to see a bit of greenery here. But you know what they did do, which I thought was really cool? They had great big planter boxes, Angus, full of bush roses.
Ah, yes.
And they just grow. They just keep, and people could come up and pick them. It was really cool. And the next day, you know, they'd replace things, but the colours were just divine.
Well, the Mediterranean is one of the places where roses are just absolutely magnificent because of the sort of long, dry summers. And for anyone in Australia or New Zealand, the place to really grow roses is where you have those long, dry summers, much like Greece, Italy, Spain, and so there is a very good reason why they do so well there.
Look, it's been really nice to chat to you today, Angus, and we'll go off it. Not only have we got the veggie patch, our spring collection of roses is going to look fantastic.
Indeed. Well, I would encourage you also to think about olives.
Yes.
That's another one of the great Mediterranean pleasures.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
This is an interesting topic, Michael. Find out what mathematicians, baseball players and dancers have in common.
It sure is. Look, I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Greenstein, or as she's known, Dr. G. Hi, Dr. G.
Hello, hello, hello. Actually, right now I'm in the Baltimore, Washington area of the United States.
How lovely.
Now, you're internationally, I guess, known as a thought leader who delivers the power and wisdom of truly applied neuroscience. Tell us a little bit about the work that you do.
Right. I am so excited to share this with you because in the last decade, the amount of information that has come into the public domain from scientific journals and books written by neuroscientists have changed the way we think about education and medicine and business and even design. And I'm speaking specifically about probably the greatest revolution in neuroscience, which is the understanding of neuroplasticity,
mm-hmm.
or the ability to really change our brains, to grow all the way through our lives, through new learning, through good exercise, through practice.
What's the benefits for humans as we get older to keep all these things moving? I mean, does it reduce illnesses and things like that too?
Oh gosh, I'll tell you, this is what's so exciting, and I'm really glad that Mind Food is taking this topic up, because if you actually work the areas of your brain where there's new learning, where it's called episodic memory, then you actually you can increase the chances of warding off Alzheimer's later on in life. On the area of the brain that is well known in the neuroscience anatomy circles is called the hippocampus. So this area is known specifically for new learning, for episodic short-term memory, and it's activated by spatial memory practice.
Why do ballroom dancers or dancers and mathematicians and baseball players have in common? What is it that you talk about that they've got in common?
Yeah, they have in common two large networks in the brain that demand spatial reasoning. Right. So, for instance, dancers orient with their bodies in space, right? Gymnasts, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're using an area of the brain, not only they're using in terms of the relationship to gravity, to the floor, right, to the walls around them.
Mm.
That's what you could say hippocampal spatial memory, but they're also using an area of the brain that's called the parietal lobe, where you're learning about number sense, how much things are, your body orientation and location in space. So dancers, from the get-go, are activating the spatial memory network.
So for people listening in today, what could they do to start to develop some of these techniques? If they're sitting there thinking, you know, I really should do that part-time course at night, is that going to help them?
Right, well, what I want to say is, what if they were to trade, I mean, you know, Sudoku is good, you know, Sudoku is fun, right?
Yeah.
Crossword puzzle fun. But what if they were to practice brushing their teeth with a different hand?
Okay.
Where they have to use the orient, right?
Yep.
What if they were to take a walk, and they walked around the block in a different way, and they notice new things?
Mm-hmm.
And then when they get home, see if they can recall in their memory the new things they noticed in space.
Really what you're saying is get yourself out of habits.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yes. And learn new things that in a spatial way. And if we don't use spatial memory, particularly as young children, we start to see shrinkage in the hippocampal network, and that's not good for learning.
Mm. Dr. G, thank you very much for being on today's show. It really makes us think, this sort of this subject matter. It's all about smart thinking.
It is all about smart thinking and thinking of things in different ways. Whole brain learning for the whole brain child, the thought process, and all those things involved with neuroscience. Thanks for joining us, Dr. G.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Well, we've got Dr. Lee Hodder, who has been on the show before, and she's actually one of the most clicked-through podcasts on mindfood.com. Really fascinating.
Yeah, cool.
And her last interview was all about the brain. Today, we're actually talking all about creativity, and we think it's such an important part, we're going to break it into two interviews. So, Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, welcome back to the show, I guess I should say.
Absolutely.
That's pretty impressive, isn't it? One of the most clicked-through podcasts.
It is. It just goes to show that everyone's very concerned about their brain health, and that's great.
Yeah.
And creativity, what's that all about?
Well, there's an increasing call, particularly in the business world these days, to think outside the square. But unfortunately, we tend to lose touch with that ability to think creatively once we start going to school, where the emphasis is on the logical linear thinking.
Yeah.
We tend to lack confidence then in our abilities.
What happens when we finish school and then we get thrown into university, or we go to a college? And then all of a sudden, you're in an environment where, guess what? Now you've got to be creative.
Yeah, it's scary because it's something that we haven't done for at least 12 years of the schooling, and people just get terrified there. I think they're afraid of making a mistake, and that's one of the primary blocks to creative thinking, is actually thinking that there is a right answer.
Is everybody creative, though?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, they are.
So what do you know, when you talk about creativity, sometimes people would say, oh, they're eccentric.
Yeah, that could be called that.
Yeah.
degrees of creativity, but the basic definition of creative thinking is it's about the generation of novel solutions to problems.
Just say that again, because I'm really mulling that over.
Sure.
Because that does make so much sense. Say it again.
Yeah, it's the generation of novel solutions to problems, and that came from Edward de Bono.
That is true, but you know, I think more and more businesses are realising that they need more creativity in their workforce. You know, as people are losing their jobs and people are being made redundant, you know, it's often people that perhaps think outside the square that have those solutions that companies and businesses, and in fact individuals, really need. You know, I've just written an editorial all about following your dream and you know, now's the time to do it. You know, get out there and do it and be brave and follow it. And it's all that creative thought.
Yes, it is. In fact, there are some businesses now that have dedicated innovation managers, which is an interesting thing, because we're in these sort of economic times, we're all being asked to do more with less.
Yeah.
And creative thinking really feeds into that nicely.
So if you're in a job at the moment and, you know, you're going through every day, to do, you know, doing your job and going about it, what should you be doing to add to this creativity to make yourself more employable in today's world?
They've got to have high levels of curiosity about the world. They've got to have risk-taking ability and courage and persistence and the ability to nurture new ideas, even though they might seem very out there, and to see how far they can take them. So it's all a brave new world.
So if you were at work, what would you be encouraging somebody to do? Is it going to see a life coach or have counselling or put yourself into a course?
Yeah, put yourself into a course. Feel free to break the rules, beg, borrow and steal from other industries as such. If they've maybe had a similar idea, look at how they've gone about solving it and see if there's anything you can borrow from that. There's a whole heap of stuff that people can do. Get rid of perfectionism and just realise that creativity is messy and it's not perfect and you may not get it right the first few times, but you just never know where the next idea is going to come from out of all that mess.
Now, in our first interview, you talked about certain techniques and creativity tips. What are they?
Okay, creativity needs time, which can cost money. It needs space, as in headspace. And space for people to spread out and do all their mind maps and all those sorts of things. It needs the ability to be playful and have a laugh, and that's usually when you can tell a group's right into the creative thing. They their energy picks up and they start laughing and having fun.
Yeah.
It needs passion, which you sound like you've got for Mind Food, definitely. And it needs training also to be able to look for associations between things that you may not have associated before.
So if you own a business today and you're driving along or sitting at home listening to this interview, what are some things that you should be doing to encourage your staff to be creative? Because I imagine out of the creativity could actually mean a more profitable company.
Oh, absolutely it does. Absolutely. Do things like have free dress day. I think the corporate suit thing doesn't really lend itself to being creative. People need to be able to get down on the floor and do things like play marbles, for example, because while they're doing that, their subconscious mind is actually working on the problem.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to cultivate is that subconscious ability.
Mm. For small business owners, though, Lee, listening to this today, and, you know, they might have staffing issues or a problem staff or things like that, from a creativity point of view, how do you move that problem out of your business, or how do you kind of enter into a realm that you can kind of free yourself in the business of that?
Sure. They can people in small business can actually hire creativity mentors. They can get facilitators in, external facilitators to help them with that, because two heads are better than one when it comes to brainstorming, etc.
Yeah.
I call it innovation coaching.
Mm.
Yeah, so you just go in and you help them set up what they need in order to have an innovative business culture, for example, and it's quite different to the normal organisational culture, which is usually very rigid and very set in its ways.
So what's an example of something that you've worked with where it's been down in the doldrums and you've been able to reinvigorate something?
There's a company, a small one that I'm working with at the moment. It's got a quite a hierarchical structure, And what we're trying to do is flatten it out. So the first thing I got them to do was all come into a room, and is what is typical in those things is that managers will sit with managers and team leaders will sit with team leaders and operators will sit with operators. So I got them to do almost like a speed dating game to start off with. And what they had to do was meet everyone in the room for 5 minutes each and find one thing in common. And that took us right through to after morning tea. And when they came back into the room, instead of sitting in their groups, they were all sitting higgledy-piggledy next to each other, and the barriers had come down. So that was one of the first things we did for them.
How important do you think is an open plan office compared to, you know, small little offices?
I think both are needed in an organisation. I think it's important to have breakout rooms where maybe smaller groups of people who are trying to generate or grow an idea can just go off and do it without being disturbed by the larger group. The best office setup that I've seen is where they've got an open plan in the middle and then they've got breakout rooms around the outside of it.
Well, look, it's been very, very interesting talking to you. And for more details, you can go to mindfood.com. But Dr. Lee, final points, closing points. What's one thing that we can do right now?
If you have an issue, explain it to a child or to a group of children in their language. So you'll have to simplify it and not dumb it down, but certainly simplify it and use words that they'll understand and see what they come up with.
Oh, how cool
is
that?
Because kids have a way of cutting through all the garbage.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I'm going to ask
Pleasure.
That when I repaint the office. This next guest, Michael, has got a very interesting topic. And, you know, Alzheimer's, dementia, it affects everybody and everybody's family and young and old.
It sure does. I'd like to today welcome to the show Andrew Italia. He's the facilitator for the Department of Learning and Development for Understanding Dementia and Alzheimer's at Alzheimer's Australia. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Now, the work you do in and around understanding dementia and Alzheimer's is really interesting. And tell us a little bit about that.
Part of my role is to go out to various health professionals and certainly talk about what dementia actually is, different forms of looking out for signs, symptoms, and more importantly, strategies to care for people with dementia and certainly trying to maintain quality of life for those people.
Andrew, can you tell us what the difference is between dementia and Alzheimer's?
Dementia is a term we use for the symptoms. So if someone's showing signs or certain symptoms such as memory problems, language issues, a loss of various skills and abilities, then after stringent testing and so forth, then there may be a diagnosis of dementia, but there are different forms of dementia. So Alzheimer's disease is a form of dementia. It is the most common, but there are well over 100 different forms of dementia.
Oh, really?
That's right.
Oh, okay. Now, can dementia just happen in old people?
We know that the older we get, the higher the risk. In saying that, though, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's only left to the over 65s. We certainly know that people under 65 can get dementia.
Yeah.
People in their 30s, 40s, 50s.
From your perspective and the work that you do, is there something we should be doing as, you know, adults and humans much earlier on so we can kind of escape dementia? Or is it going to come anyway?
We're probably too late now.
No, it's never too late, Michael. I think at the end of the day, look, you're absolutely right. There are things that we can certainly do no matter how old we are.
Mm.
Now, I suppose it's important to point out there's nothing I'll say here that which I can say which will prevent us from getting dementia. However, we know that there are some really good risk reduction strategies, and keeping yourself mentally active and challenging our brains is extremely important. There's some fantastic research which does point out that if we do build further connections in our brain and challenge ourselves, increase the neurons in our brain, then what that does is give us at the very least, I suppose, a chance of delaying the onset of getting dementia.
For people that are listening today that perhaps, you know, they have a friend or a family member that are showing signs of dementia, what can they do?
I think first and foremost, we know that if there are concerns, there are many things which could mimic dementia. So you want to get that family member to a GP just to see if there's something else which is causing those sorts of signs and symptoms.
Yeah.
Now, there may be some things which are well and truly solvable or curable, and that's fantastic. Now,
yeah.
on the other side, of course, if it is dementia, then the beauty of getting an early diagnosis is that there are forms of medication out there which won't cure, unfortunately, but certainly will delay the progression of their dementia, which is what we're after, at least giving that person a greater of quality in their lives for as long as possible.
Andrew, thank you very much for being on today's show. It's the work that you do out in the community and making people more aware of dementia and Alzheimer's is very important.
Yeah, very important.
I know through the pages of Mind Food, you know, the stories that we do in and around the subject matter, we get a lot of feedback. So I'm sure today's interview would have helped many.
That's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me, gentlemen, and keep up the great work with Mind Food. I love it myself.
Fantastic. Oh, good on you.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Well, Michael, the other night we went out for dinner. I love desserts.
I know. And the thing is, who doesn't love dessert?
We're all sharing them at the table and comparing.
We have. Now, on today's show, we've got Lyndall Miller, a joint author of the cookbook With Sugar, Desserts. It's beautiful, Lyndall.
Yum.
It's a really great book. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Why did you focus on desserts? Is that your passion?
It is one of my passions. But the book deal we got was through her success on MasterChef Series 2.
Oh, wow.
And the fact that I came on as a co-author was actually really an amazing gift from Skye. She wanted me to co-author the book with her, have a shared passion for desserts, and I'm a big foodie and a long history in the food industry, and I'm also a food stylist. So I jumped at the opportunity, obviously, and it is one of those things that I just absolutely love, and it's my gift of choice for my loved ones.
Your gift of choice. So tell us, what do you love to cook in terms of the dessert menu? What would be something you'd cook for the family?
I loved all the really old-fashioned desserts, like the trifle that we got featured on the front cover of Wild Sugar Desserts. It's a bit of a modern spin on an old traditional favourite.
Mm-hmm.
And I love those because we have such memories around desserts in our family in particular. You know, whether a Christmas or a birthday, it would always be, you know, Mark coming out and saying, you know, what sort of cake do you want, or what sort of dessert would you like? And on these special occasions, and we'd get all excited, and we didn't really steer very far from the old traditional favourites.
And as you were growing up, Lyndall, did you have a favourite dessert?
My mother's chocolate cake was a really big favourite. And a French custard she used to always make too was also a favourite. It was really hard to sort of pick one.
And was there a defining moment in your life that, you know, drove you to kind of making this book? Because it's absolutely beautiful. Like, I'm sitting here looking at it and I want to eat everything.
Thank you. You know, I watch my mother with an eagle eye, as she has, and she just loves to entertain and, you know, brought up in a quintessential sort of 70s home where, you know, entertaining became quite in. And I just love all the passion that she put into, you know, each event or gathering. And it wasn't so much, you know, what the dessert that she was serving up, but she was making it with love. And I think that really made a really big impression on me, watching her and the way that she basically cooks with love.
And that's what it's all about, isn't it, really?
I think so. Definitely.
Well, Lyndall, I'm going to run off and grab a cup of sugar, and Michael and I might try and throw something together backstage.
Fantastic. Like to hear how that goes.
Thanks for joining us on today's program. Michael's already
so
gone off.
Thanks for having me.
Very insightful, Michael. A throwback to the old-fashioned days of cooking, hey?
It is, and it's a beautiful cookbook. You really should make it one on your, you know, your cookbook shelf. It really is gorgeous. With Sugar, and we've just interviewed Lyndall Miller.
And that's a wrap, as we say in the business. Thank you very much for your company today. Well, very interesting there, talking about creativity, Dr. Lee Hodder. Of course, if you'd like some more information on anything you've heard on today's program, jump onto mindfood.com, and you can also listen to some of our podcasts there as well. Interesting interview with Andrew Itala today, talking about understanding Alzheimer's. David Welsh giving us some good advice there on nutrition and exercise. And first up, Jacqueline Hellier. She's always good with the sex advice. Well, join us next week at this time right here on your favourite station. And of course, for more details, you can jump onto our fabulous website, mindfood.com. Until next week, thank you very much for your company. Have a safe week. I'm Ben Starr.
Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.